Always a great day when we get to welcome to the program from Defector and the Distraction Podcast, David Roth. Hello there, David.
How you doing, Rich?
I'm doing well, thank you. And by the way, it just worked out this way, but this is it's a pretty special moment to some excitement coming your way. Hold on, here we go. I wanted something celebratory. That's the best I could come up with. You are.
That's really nice.
Thank you. You are the 20,000th interview here on the program.
No way.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I feel like I have to have been responsible for like maybe 100 of those.
You're a lot of them.
But
oh, 20, yeah.
20,000 is so many.
It's a lot. And they were like, I mean, outside of you, there were like 9 good ones.
That's very nice. I'm sorry that it couldn't have been Kathleen Turner. I think that would have really impressed her. As you know, I'm already very impressed with you. You got nothing really. There's no ground to make up here, but it's like if you get the star body heat, be like, you're number 20,000. She wouldn't have known. You could have just done that.
We could have. I don't know that it could have topped just hearing that voice when she came on the line. Rich Kimball, hello there. How are you, darling?
I've been working on bassing up and adding some of that lower register, the rumble that right. made her so important, but it's really hard for me. That's just not the theater training that I have. But yeah, that's awesome. Congratulations on 20,000, man. That's great.
Thank you. Probably this is it. I think we'll stop today. I like round numbers.
Yeah, that's fair. We're going to hit our 10,000th post at Defector sometime tomorrow.
Whoa.
And everybody's already kind of panicking that it's just going to wind up being like luck of the draw, just somebody writing 300 words about how much they love eating chicken wings or whatever. And it's definitely, it would be on brand for that to be the case. But I don't know. We've got a lot of Olympic stuff happening, so hopefully it'll be something cool about something cool and not me, writing about my lunch and getting it up there without any other editor's approval.
Well, see, I wasn't content to rely on luck of the draw because I knew late last week, I knew you were coming on, and I knew we were getting close to it. And so you could have come on at 4 o'clock today, but at 4 o'clock you would have been number 19,997. That's not going to cut it, so...
Story of my life.
Yeah. 20,000.
Well, I'm honored. Thank you, man. And congratulations.
Thank you. Well, hey, let's talk Olympics here. Gosh, where to begin? You had some interesting, very interesting information. Great conversation on the Distraction Podcast. Who knew about cheating in weird fencing events?
Yeah, that's a Pablo Torre special. That's what he delivers. His podcast, Pablo Torre Finds Out, cannot recommend highly enough. And he came on and talked to Drew and me last week. And they had a story about saber fencing, which is... Fencing seems like one of those sports that should be cool to watch during the Olympics. Like, I don't think I'd watch it every week, but I figure every 4 years it should be good. It's really not great TV to me. Like, everything's too fast, and I kind of don't understand how to watch it. So it's just... a bunch of people dressed like beekeepers making, you know, outsized gestures at each other and at officials. But what Pablo learned in the course of reporting that story is that some impossible percentage of saber fencing matches internationally are fixed, almost all of them by one guy. And it is in sports that are at this low a level of sort of prominence. All it takes is one sufficiently motivated oligarch to completely pull the competitive balance of the sport apart, which, something to remember in watching any Olympic event. There was some extremely bad officiating in the France-Japan men's basketball game today that also, I mean, it sort of as a reminder that you don't necessarily need to fix these things for them to be screwed up by bad officiating, but I don't imagine it hurts.
No, and apparently some bad officiating in the tennis match for Coco Gauff as well.
I didn't see that. We just put a post up. What happened?
I guess a bad call that may have contributed to her losing the match, and she got pretty upset with it. Understandable in the circumstances.
Yeah, that is. I mean, it's hard with this stuff because there's the sports that you sort of think that you know how to watch. Like at this point, like I feel like I could watch a tennis match pretty well. You know, like I know what's happening. And so that it would pop that much more if some bad officiating screwed stuff up. A lot of the other stuff that I have sort of up to and including gymnastics, I just don't have the palate for understanding it. And so everything that they're doing looks incredible to me. And then, you know, so you'll see somebody do something that, not just would I die if I attempted to do it. Like, it would be five different parts of me scattered across the, you know, ballet theater where it's happening. And, you know, somebody does this impossible vault, and you can hear both the announcers being like, oh, that's too bad. You know, some sort of mistake was made that you have to be an expert to even, you know, comprehend. And I don't know. I think with tennis, yeah, this, I'm looking now at Giddy Nathan's blog, and yes, Coco does look extremely upset, not somebody that I think of as a yeller at of officials. Wow. Well, you know, this is the Olympics for you. Like, they give and they take. Like, it's been cool, and there's also always a great deal of just, I guess, slapstick comedy would be a way to describe it. It's just a very corrupt thing at its core. But I appreciate, I also like that it's happening so that it's daytime TV for me now, that I can just kind of wander out to the front of my apartment and put the kayak slalom on and call it work. Pretty nice.
Is surfing started yet? That's what I want to see.
Yeah, there's been preliminary stuff. I have to figure out where to watch it. That is one that I think is probably going to be on in the evening time because it's in Tahiti.
Oh.
And which is fascinating to me because it's like there is definitely surfing in Western Europe. But I guess if you have an excuse to go to Tahiti, even if that excuse is long ago colonial despoilation, like you gotta take advantage of it. Like, it's as close as I'm likely to get to going there, so I'm happy to watch it. I love watching surfing, but that's another one where I don't know what I'm looking at. Like, I just like watching the guys surf down the waves and seeing how big they are. Like, and the way that a dog would watch television.
And, the beauty of Paris, except don't go in the Seine because, man, that thing is just full of poop, and you'll get sick if you go in there and do your triathlon, for God's sakes.
They're gonna do it, though.
Oh,
like one of those things where that also, I remember that with similar...
It's tough setting records in hazmat gear.
Yeah, in Rio, it was the same deal, and everybody was kind of, you know that these people are very motivated. Like, being a triathlete is not glamorous, and doing a triathlon itself is, like, there's no way that you could get to a point where that's ever a physically pleasant thing to do. But if you ever doubted their dedication, the idea of, like, doing all of that and then being like, and I might get cholera to come in fifth, is really, like, pretty amazing to me. You're willing to take your chances with E. coli just to be, whatever, like, on the, whatever, the USA or E! Network, like, daytime broadcast or something, then that's, I respect that a lot.
Wasn't it just the most typically American thing that so many people were enraged at the opening ceremonies, completely misunderstanding what they were all about, and apparently having very little understanding of what it was like in Greece back in the day?
I'm assuming eventually going to wind up talking about politics. I don't want to rush us in that direction, but I do think that there's something really funny about people that are, on one hand, holding themselves out as, like, putting on the armor of God and fighting for the future of America to protect it from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Watching something on TV and seeing a metal band play in a castle during the Olympic ceremonies and being like, this is the scariest thing I've ever seen. I've never been, like, first of all, it's demonic. Second of all, it's loud. Like, that, the idea of bringing that mindset where you're constantly thinking and talking about going to war, but also you're terrified of, like, just people, like, that are dressed as clowns gambling about near the Seine in a theatrical way, tells me that you are not ready to go outside yet.
Right.
That you need to just, like, hang out and, I don't know, like, be online and post 100 times a day. I don't really know what else those people do.
Get the children to the basement, Frank. That music is so frightening.
It is. And it was, I mean, to be fair, this was the first time a metal band ever played. It was, and it was cool. But yes, the other stuff, I mean, there was like some sort of, there was like light. I mean, it was a very French opening ceremony. Every opening ceremony to me, I've learned that I can only really watch them in like 60-second chunks. It's too much for me. Like, not as a sort of, as a non-theater person, but then also just, it's the most overstated expression of whatever is wrong with whatever country is hosting the Olympics. And so in this case, the French have a lot of, you know, there's a lot of psychology going on there. There's a lot of interest. And so the the sort of like weird winking sexuality and like outsized campy relationship to their own history and everything like that. It's, I appreciated all of it, but I was not going to be able to sit down to, you know, a 12-course tasting menu of it. I just don't have it in me.
David Roth with us here on Downtown. Let's shift slightly, still within the realm of sports. How about your Mets?
How about them? They're adequate now.
Yeah.
They were so depressing early in the year that I think we haven't even talked about them yet, which, you know, is a good bit of radio on your part. I appreciate you throwing me a bone on this one. But yeah, they seem more or less to have figured out how to hit. And, you know, baseball being the way that baseball is, they were 12 games under 500 at one point. They're now 6 games over and in the wild card mix. And, you know, I don't know that they're that good. I think this is more or less what I expected them to be during the season, which is like kind of a lower end wild card team that maybe makes it or maybe doesn't, and mostly plays it pretty conservative in terms of acquisitions, which they have done so far. But the route that they took to get to like mediocre plus has utterly delighted me over the last 2 months, and I'm like back in. I went on Saturday. It was fun. They did the turn ahead the clock giveaway, so I have a Mercury Mets jersey now.
Ooh,
do you
nice.
Remember the turn ahead the clock thing?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
It's a really bizarre promotion that apparently was 100% the break. Like, it was a dumb idea that Ken Griffey Jr. thought was cool, and such was Ken Griffey's power in baseball in 1999. Mm. Every team except for 3 was like, sure, whatever, we'll make the jerseys. And they just did it.
It's a similar story with the Red Sox, although a strange thing happened. They were playing good baseball. They were surprising people. And then the night that they gave up 20 runs, that's the night they decided, let's let the world know we just signed Alex Cora to a brand new contract, and now they've lost 7 of their last 10.
Yeah, I'm worrying that there's not enough appetite on the part of the front office there for them to commit. I kind of think the Red Sox and the Mets are in similar positions, I think, except for I think it's easier for me to see how the Red Sox could make a few moves and get a lot better, and they just don't really seem that interested in doing it. I've been refreshing MLB trade rumors all afternoon, and the Red Sox haven't made a notable move. The Mets have made some very, very minor ones. Most of the, you know, it's the teams that always make the most moves, making the most moves right now, that the, you know, Padres are just acquiring every relief pitcher they can, and then they're going to figure out where to house them later, and that's just how they do it. But the Sox, to me, feel it's like this sort of disjunction. It always reminds me of the movie Major League, although obviously it's not quite as cut and dried or probably as funny as that. But there's this sense of the front office's timeline and plan, which, you know, I think is in the hands of competent people. And then the team is just playing better earlier than that plan would have suggested. And so the question is, like, are you willing to, as an organization, admit that, like, maybe you're not where you thought you were on the timeline and skip ahead and commit to this core while it's still there or not? And I think that the surprising players on the Red Sox, I'm thinking specifically of Jarren Duran, are, like, they're a little bit older than you think. Like, Jarren Duran had a few years of fits and starts before he became the extremely valuable player that he is now. And I know it's about team control and it's about budget and all of that stuff, but also, you know, if his prime is arriving more dramatically and sooner than you think, as a fan, I would want to see a team try to honor that one way or another. It doesn't mean, you know, that like you sell all out and try to, you know, whatever, bring in, I'm trying to think of who that would even be, you know, like trade for Logan Gilbert and George Kirby or something like that. Like, that's not reasonable, but I would like to see them give it a shot. And my guess is they'll get a relief pitcher or two, or like, you know, I thought they were going to get like Paul DeJong or somebody like that. But so far they haven't done that, either of those things just yet.
Well, we'll see how it all,
how are you feeling about it? I guess this is, I don't know to what extent you're living and dying with these guys.
Well, I'm loving the,
what do you want them to do?
The team has been fun because they've
right.
Cora's done a great job. They emphasize speed, which, you know, I haven't seen since, I was a youngster watching every game played on artificial turf on the road. So it's kind of fun. They've got a youth movement that's pretty cool. I don't want them to mortgage the future to make a run at that third wild card spot. So, you know, I'm happy they picked up, they got Paxton, they picked up Danny Jansen from the Blue Jays. I guess they got a reliever from the Marlins this afternoon, Lucas Sims. The Reds, rather.
They got Lucas Sims.
Yeah.
He's good. He's pretty good.
Yeah, so not bad. I'm good with that. And it'd be nice, one more bullpen piece, just so I don't have to watch them implode every other night when the starter leaves with a three-run lead and a guy comes in from the bullpen and walks the first three that he faces.
Yeah. Well, the guy that you want, if you want to add another guy that can do that, the Mets have DFA Jake Diekman. I know you've had the Jake Diekman experience.
We've seen that, yes. Yeah.
But you're interested in having a guy that looks stressed out and bearded throw 11 straight balls. He's your dude.
All right, we'll keep that in mind. I'll send a message out to management here.
Yeah.
Get this taken care of.
Craig Breslow.
I'm looking back. I mean, we talk to you every month, but politically, the time between our last conversation and today might as well be an entire election cycle with everything weird that has gone on. What's the biggest, or no, forget biggest or most important, what's the most entertaining element of what's gone on here in the last several weeks?
Well, it is hard to try to like figure out where to even begin with it, because it's like, so it's been something like 10 days since Biden dropped out, which means it's been something like 17 days since someone took a shot at Donald Trump. Like, that's so 2.5 weeks. It's crazy that we are in a situation where neither of those are the current issue. Like, the idea that Trump got shot at, that was like a very dramatic thing. Somehow his favorability rating went down after assassination attempt, which is really what I guess you would describe as the Donald Trump difference.
Mm.
But then we've also got I think regardless of what kind of candidate Kamala Harris is, everybody I know that was dreading this election and being like, I'm going to vote for Biden, but I don't feel great about any of this. Like, all of those people's moods, including mine, have done something like a 180. In this case, like, I think that there's just, regardless of what the outcome is going to be, and obviously you're not going to have America's saddest Mets fan come on your radio show to guess what the election is going to wind up being like, but there is a sense of possibility and just of things like maybe being different that I really feel like wasn't there. And it's hard to, you know, put that into words. It always, I think a lot of the worst political journalism is about this sort of idea of vibes and sort of trying to assess like what, you know, how something feels one way or the other. But I will also say that, just, you know, anecdotally, however you want to spin it, that the vibes were bad and now the vibes are no longer bad. And I don't think, you know, I think that the thing that was always, to the extent that I was sort of holding out hope, and I'm, you know, cards on the table, I do not want Donald Trump to be president again. I don't know if that'll surprise you or scandalize any listeners.
No, they've gone. Those listeners have gone a long time ago, I suspect.
I'd imagine. But I think that there's also this sense of, like, everybody, no one is going to be convinced by him that is not already convinced by him. He's not capable of making an argument. And I think that there's, like, the people that are hardcore, like, all in for Donald Trump are also not going to be convinced one way or another. They're not in it for, you know, reasons having to do with policy or like comparing the relative, you know, pluses and deltas of the different candidates and their programs. Like, that's not what this is about. And to the extent that there, you know, there is obviously this glaring difference between what a second, you know, Biden-Harris sort of term would look like and what a Trump term would look like. And that's been an issue, I think, that, like, to see the way that Project 2025 has actually been like a topic of conversation among normal people and in a way that policy never is, it's kind of, that's heartening just in itself. It's also heartening that people look at it and are like, ugh, I don't want anything to do with that. But Trump's percentage of the vote is what it is. It's not going to change. And so the idea that there is, you know, all of these people that were feeling left out or checked out or bummed out one way or the other, suddenly feeling some other type of way, seems to me very promising. And I certainly, you know, enjoy not being under the rain cloud of feeling like we really were going to have this terrible outcome one way or another. Like, either everybody gets it together and we carry this mummified husk of the president over the line for a second term, or like something worse than that. Neither one of them was inspiring, and now we've got something that doesn't feel quite as bad.
Well, and like next to the change at the top of the ticket, the other thing that I found both encouraging and entertaining is J.D. Vance being a vice presidential nominee.
You like the experience of just looking at him, thinking about the things he
thinks
about.
Oh, my word, my word. And it, weird is, I know the coin of the realm, that's the go-to phrase now, but boy, it never fit anybody better than it does J.D. Vance. What a strange, strange man.
Yeah, I feel like there's a couple of ways in which he's strange, and some of them, you know, it's not, at the end, it's not really important what J.D. Vance actually thinks in his heart of hearts, because we know what he says he's going to do. And we can see how he's voted. So it doesn't matter if he secretly thinks that all of the stuff that he's saying is BS and he's just saying it to please the Silicon Valley creeps that have bankrolled his political career. Maybe he is. It doesn't matter. That the things that he's saying are, and if you're somebody that spends a lot of time online, you're already familiar with a lot of this stuff, all the weird stuff about birth rates and, you know, basically like some sort of like dressed up version of the Great Replacement idea.
Yeah, and it's so the thing is, it's not a one-off for him. You can find about 30 instances of him on the internet talking about people who don't have kids and what's wrong with them.
It's a weird fixation. It is also a weird fixation when you consider that, like, most of the people, so the people that he's basically acting as a court jester for, you know, like your Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, David Sachs, types, and Mark Andreessen, the Silicon Valley billionaire types that have taken this increasingly reactionary turn and have bankrolled Vance's career from the start. But those people are not necessarily, like, they're even weirder than him. Like, this is the most normal, most professional presentation of those ideas that you can get, and it's still somebody that looks like a haunted doll going on Sebastian Gorka's podcast and talking about how we need to have real-time monitoring of every American menstrual cycle for reasons having to do with freedom and the, you know, furtherance of the white race. That's very unappealing. Like, just on the merits, nobody wants to hear that. Like, maybe Sebastian Gorka's listeners do, but I don't want to know what else those people want.
It's a strange world, and we got another, 98 days of it left to go, so but we'll check in again as we get closer and see where we are. In the meantime, David, thank you as always for joining us. Have you made your summer pilgrimage to Maine yet?
Yep, we've been and gone. I'd like to, if it's okay, I would like to shout out a small business.
Please do.
To my bacon while I was up there. We had a terrible time getting up. Just a lot of hijinks and a lot of mistakes. I dropped my phone when we were in southern Maine, and then that was right around July 4th. And I dropped it off at Midcoast Mobile in Belfast, Maine. Shout out to Chris Quimby for fixing my phone. Thanks for that.
Nice.
T-Mobile wouldn't do it. I was, for some reason, out of warranty. So this man came through, and in the course of a week, I spent a week without my phone, and that felt amazing. but now I have it back. And, you know, it has its ups and downs, but I do get to talk to you. Otherwise, I don't know how we would have done this.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm glad everything worked out in the end. That's what we try to do here in Maine, make the world a better place in some small way.
The way life should be, right?
There you go. I've seen that on a sign somewhere. Hey, we'll see you again 20,000 interviews down the road.
Right on. Thank you, man.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Thanks, David. David Roth, Defector, the Distraction Podcast with us here on